Officials say Better Buying Power 3.0 mostly represents a shift in focus. While the Pentagon is not abandoning the initiatives it outlined in the first two versions, which were mostly focused on better management of the acquisition system from a cost perspective, it is placing more of a premium on specific steps officials believe are needed to drive technical excellence into the systems the military buys. Frank Kendall is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics.
Our technological superiority is at risk. It is eroding because we're not making the investments we should be making. The threat of sequestration, even the cuts to the level we've already taken them, pose problems for us in terms of maintaining technological superiority. That's one of the things behind this thrust and this version of Better Buying Power towards that end of the spectrum, towards the products that we're providing and how well we're doing at providing the right kinds of products.
Strictly speaking, the latest version of the initiative is still in draft form. Kendall's office plans to spend the next few months gathering feedback from industry, think tanks, and Congress before it drafts implementation instructions for DoD acquisition officials. But the thrust of the initiatives is in keeping with a task Kendall has already been given by Deputy Defense Secretary Bob Work. Begin work on a new generation of breakthrough technologies that will be game changers in future warfare. In much the same way that Work that began in the 1970s made the U.S. dominant for the last three decades. Kendall says DoD will implement a stronger department-wide approach to long-range R&D planning.
But it's modeled after that earlier activity, and it will be designed to set out the next few years of high-priority R&D to get us to a position where we'll have technologies we can take into game-changing systems. If you look back to the study that I referred to that was done in the 70s, a lot of the capability we have today came out of that study. Things like smart weapons, smart seekers, some of our networking technologies, and other things. Things that have dominated, allowed us to dominate in the battlefield for quite a long time now. The idea is to get to the next generation of those things, find out what they are, do it in a coherent way, and then focus our resources on programs that are going to change the game. If we don't do that, the concern I had about technological superiority is going to become even greater.
To help with that long-range planning, Kendall says he plans to build tighter links between the department's acquisition system and the intelligence community. That's an extension of the effort DoD began in Better Buying Power 2.0 when it said it wanted to more closely pair the acquisition and requirements communities.
What I want to do is have a more continuous interaction, and I want to ask the intelligence community to help us understand not just what the evidence shows right now the threat might be doing, but what is a logical response by the threat to the things that we're doing. So we try to anticipate that and account for that in our designs. So it's more of a continuing relationship that allows us to respond more quickly when threats do change. If you take a long program like the F-35, and a lot of our programs are going to take multiple years, several years to develop, the threats change over the course of that period of time, right? And we have some mechanisms in place to kind of watch that and then start to react if it does. I want to strengthen those mechanisms, and I want to make them more responsive so that the intelligence community knows what we're interested in. It's watching for those things specifically, and it alerts us as soon as it sees indications of change so that we can respond more effectively.
While some of the points in the 3.0 version are restatements of policies the department has already been pushing, like more open systems architectures and rapid prototyping programs, several of the items are new. For instance, Kendall says the department will launch a new effort to identify and remove barriers that prevent DoD from buying more commercial technology.
This is one of the items on 3.0 where we're going to put a team together, we're going to work with industry, and we're going to go develop specific things to implement this broad goal. Technology, of course, in a number of commercial areas moves much more quickly than military areas. We want to take advantage of that. We want to find a way to bring innovators who are in the commercial world, give them a reason to be involved with the government and do business with the government. So we're going to try to improve our performance there. And we're open to ideas on that.
Likewise, Kendall says the department needs more of an open mind when it comes to discovering what technological advances might be available from foreign companies.
This one gets at the need to not be so closed in where we look for technology. We have a lot of very capable partners in the world, a lot of other countries who do good work. And we're looking for opportunities to co-develop and do sharing of the burden of developing a new product and then better scales, economic scale, production once we get into production.
The new version of Better Buying Power also includes several items that Kendall says are designed to give industry additional incentives to innovate. One of them is based on findings Kendall's office came away with after its first two annual reports on the performance of the DoD acquisition system. He says they concluded that there was a strong correlation between the use of incentive-type contracts and better performance, both in cost-type and fixed-price scenarios. The new guidance emphasizes that DoD is not requiring incentive-type contracts in every scenario, but that managers should give them at least some level of preference.
Formulaic incentives, we call them, where possibilities for cost increases or savings are shared between industry and the government, are very effective at getting results. You can set those arrangements up a wide variety of ways, but these seem to be the best forms of contracting for many of the things we do. That's true, and incidentally, it's true of cost-plus incentive and fixed-price incentive. And actually, there is a stronger correlation to using the incentives in our results than there is to whether it's a cost-plus or a fixed-price contract.
And now that the department is putting a premium on innovation, Kendall says it needs to do a much better job of communicating to industry exactly how much it's willing to pay for added capabilities.
We're doing this already. We've done it on a pilot basis, essentially, but we're doing it more and more broadly. The idea here is that we need to give industry a reason to bid higher performance to us if they think it would be attractive to us in a product. The reason meaning that you'll get selected in the source selection process. The way we've been doing this for a very long time now is we put out requirements that have an objective level and a threshold level. An objective level is what we'd sort of like to have if it were possible and we could afford it. The threshold level is what we really want to have. That's sort of our minimum that we want to have in the product. Industry bids to the threshold levels, and nobody expects otherwise, because that's generally going to be cheaper. And unless there's some way to get credit for being above that level, there's no reason to bid above that level. The idea here is we will tell industry what it's worth to us to have more performance. We'll pay another, let's just say, 10% if you get us to the higher level performance, or we'll pay another 30%. Now, you still have to be below our overall affordability cap. But once industry understands that, then they can decide if it's in their interest to bid something that's better than the minimum, that they're going to have a better chance of winning and getting the contract.
Better Buying Power 3.0 will also begin to ask questions about the value DoD's getting for the research dollars it's already spending, both within its own labs and for the industry-initiated research that the government winds up reimbursing. Kendall says it's not clear that the department is getting as much return on investment as it should be for the $30 billion it spends on its own laboratories every year, so his office plans an examination of their missions, strategies, organizations, and productivity. He says DoD will ask similar questions about industry-independent R&D and contracted R&D.
We've got to look hard at this work. We've done some things on IRAD in particular already under earlier versions of Better Buying Power. We've improved our ability to communicate with industry. We have a better understanding of what industry is doing. They have better access to what the government is doing with our funded R&D and our in-house R&D. We want to go a step further with this and start looking at what we're actually getting out of this, both of these pots of money. The first one, IRAD, is about $4 to $4.5 billion a year, and CRAD is somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion a year. So that's a significant amount of money. Our total R&D budget right now is running about $60 billion. So you can see that we're talking about a fairly significant fraction here.
Improving the professionalism of DoD's own acquisition workforce has been a focus area of Better Buying Power since 2010. The technological superiority slant on that will mean a new effort to build the engineering competencies of the workforce based on the notion that the government can't be a good buyer if the people on its side of the bargaining table don't have the same level of knowledge and skills as the companies they're buying from.
Some people have the idea, which I think is not correct, that if you're a good manager and a good leader, you can run anything. I don't believe that that is true. I would not take a group of trial lawyers who are doing litigation and ask someone who is a good manager and a good leader, but not a lawyer, to supervise that group of people as they did their work. I would not ask a person who was not a physician or a surgeon to supervise a group of doctors who were surgeons as they did their work and doing their work. And I would not ask someone who is not an engineer to run a development program where the fundamental job you're doing is engineering. I just think that that's a recipe for failure. And I have seen some examples of that. You need to understand what you're doing if you're going to supervise it effectively. And so I'm pushing us towards a stronger line. Some of the services are in pretty good shape on this. Others are not. And I think we need to emphasize this as we go through our selection of people for some of our key jobs. So that'll be a big part of that. And I think that the services need to really recognize the criticality of those kinds of professionals, those kinds of qualified leaders and managers for their development programs, which is where we tend to get in trouble in our programs.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.